Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The future of the Affordable Care Act was a central issue in the midterm elections, which saw Democrats take control of the House in part by attacking Republicans who supported repeal. But the issue also is in the courts. 20 conservative attorneys general have brought a suit to abolish the health care coverage, also known as Obamacare. And more than a dozen Democrat-led states have intervened in the lawsuit. A ruling is expected soon, but any decision likely will wind up before the U.S. Supreme Court. So we're talking about short-term and long-term views of the Affordable Care Act today. Politico healthcare reporter Alice Olstein has been covering the issue. She joins us by phone. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Let's start with the lawsuit. What happens if a federal judge in Texas sides with Republican attorneys general and the Trump administration on this law?
Well, there are a number of potential outcomes, so it's a big question mark, and Congress really is just waiting with their breath held to see what comes out of the courts and how they have to respond. So the court could side with the attorneys general, the Republican attorneys general, who are arguing that the entire Affordable Care Act has to be struck down because, as they say, it was not meant to survive without the individual mandate, which Congress repealed as part of the tax bill last year. Mm-hmm. And the Trump administration only agreed with them in part. They said, no, you don't have to strike down the whole law, but you do have to get rid of the protections for pre-existing conditions, which happened to be the most popular part of the law. So that is pending in court. The judge could, yes, strike down the entire Affordable Care Act, which means goodbye Medicaid expansion, goodbye all of the protections and the subsidies and all of that. Or the judge could say, okay, just these patient protections have to go. Either way, as you said, it will likely be appealed up to the Fifth Circuit and potentially the Supreme Court. The judge could stay his ruling pending the appeal, saying, okay, I'm going to rule that this part of the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional, but nothing will happen because the appeal is going on. But regardless, there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of confusion, and that makes it very difficult for people who are choosing whether or not to sign up for health care right now during open enrollment.
Why did the Trump administration want to get rid of the pre-existing conditions, the most popular aspect of the coverage?
Well, politically, it's a confusing stance.
Yeah.
As we saw, the election completely hinged on this question. And you had Democrats out on the campaign trail blasting Republicans for all of their attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act last year and for years prior, ever since it was enacted. And they won back the House on the strength of those arguments. And so the Trump administration, at the same time arguing in court that those protections have to go, was not a great look for Republicans. But this is hinging on the argument that Congress, when they passed the Affordable Care Act originally, did not intend for, they intended it as a package deal, and that you couldn't pick and choose which pieces you liked. And now that the mandate is gone, the rest have to go too because they're so intertwined legally. This is something many legal minds disagree with. They say Congress debated repealing the whole thing many times and actively chose not to and chose just to repeal the mandate. So the congressional record's pretty clear, and they think this lawsuit will get thrown out on appeal.
How might the incoming Democrat-controlled House respond in January?
Well, again, they're waiting to see what the court does. There's a lot of discussion on whether they should try to do something proactive before we hear from the court, which, again, could happen at any moment, but could go for months or even a year with the appeals process. So Democrats are, they're in a bit of a pickle because they, again, ran on this very clear, strong message of we will protect pre-existing conditions, but now comes the hard part. Now it's, well, how exactly do we do that? How is it best to pass a policy? So there are those in Congress who want to pass a bill that allows the House to become a party in the lawsuit and argue in court defending the Affordable Care Act. So that's a potential move for them. Of course, that doesn't guarantee a good outcome in court for them. It just gives them a voice. And there are other lawmakers, Democrats, who say we should just codify the protections for pre-existing conditions outside of Obamacare, just pass a bill protecting those. That way, if the court strikes it down, we still have them, But there are a lot of legal issues and potential pitfalls there. And so there's a lot of hesitation about trying to go down that road. And they're still working out the details.
What about the message? You know, so that was, obviously this was a big, loud message to Republicans as well. And last week, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that Congress could find a way to work on repairs in a bipartisan manner when it comes to the Affordable Care Act. And House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi said her caucus has a responsibility to seek, as she put it, common ground. She also said they also have a responsibility to hold their ground if they can't find a commonality. But there was a big, strong message to Republicans. Is this an opportunity for Democrats to tap into that and move things forward?
Potentially. So there is also a lot of desire in the Democratic caucus to put Republicans in the hot seat. And if they put up a bill saying,
right,
you know, we want to protect pre-existing conditions, it's saying to Republicans, okay, you claimed on the campaign trail that you were for this. Now it's time to see where you really stand. And there's a lot of desire to do that and to put them on the spot. But like you said, there's also currently, these appeals to bipartisanship and stating the desire to work together, but we've just seen so much division on the healthcare question over the past few years, and within the Republican caucus also. They had full control of the House, Senate, and White House last year, and were not able to come together on a healthcare plan. And so I'm not confident we're going to see a lot of collaboration. I think there are a few areas they could work together on. There's a desire to revive a sort of Obamacare stabilization bill, which would help shore up the markets, although the markets are doing a lot better than they were a few years ago. So maybe less of a pressure to do that than when we saw these giant spikes and in premiums and insurers leaving the markets. Now we're seeing insurers coming back into the markets, and we're seeing lower increases. So there's also a lot of talk about doing something about drug prices. Mm-hmm. But again, the devil's in the details, and Democrats and Republicans have very different ideas of how that should be addressed.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Politico healthcare reporter Alice Miranda Olstein. We're talking about what's happening in Washington now that the midterms are over. The Democrats have taken the House, and they will take control of the House in January. And what's up with the Affordable Care Act? If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It seems, Alice, that things are more uncertain than ever, and yet that's usually what's affected the markets, but they're stronger than they have been in recent years.
They are, although there are some new things being thrown at them this year, and the impact is unknown. So this year, for the first time, the Trump administration is allowing the sale of what were referred to as short-term limited duration plans, because you used to only be able to buy them for 3 months, you know, if you were between jobs or something. And those are plans that don't have to follow Obamacare's rules. They don't have to cover pre-existing conditions. They don't have to cover essential health benefits. There are these cheap plans that were originally supposed to be sort of a bridge to get you back to comprehensive health care. But now they're allowed to be sold like a normal health plan. So it is completely unknown how many people will go for these cheaper, skimpier plans and leave the Obamacare markets with the comprehensive plans, which could drain those markets of maybe young, healthy people who think they don't need the full package. And if those people leave the markets, premiums will go up. It will be damaging. But again, it's unknown. Some states have passed bills banning or limiting those short-term plans, which Democrats in Congress call junk plans because of how little they cover. Mm-hmm. And so that's another big uncertainty. Also, the Trump administration has cut the budget for outreach and for enrollment assistance even more than last year.
Oh, really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that could lead to lower enrollment. So there's a lot of things going on. So even though insurers are coming back into the market, they're profitable right now. Enrollment did drop for the first time since the Affordable Care Act was enacted. It went a little bit down from 2017 to 2018. So it's unknown what'll happen now. So it's as ever a wait and see on healthcare.
Boy, this must be more fun than a barrel of monkeys to cover for you. And I can't even imagine.
It's never boring.
Three more states expanded Medicaid coverage by way of ballot issues to tap into that aspect of the Affordable Care Act. Utah, Idaho, and Nebraska, three pretty safely Republican strongholds, if memory serves me. How does that affect the dynamic in Washington with these three states signing on?
Well, the more and more states expand Medicaid, the more lawmakers who represent those states have an interest in protecting the Affordable Care Act. If millions of people, well, hundreds of thousands benefiting from the expansion and you know, millions being enrolled overall. But, it makes it harder to repeal. It expands the reach of Obamacare and people's investment in it and how many people are benefiting from it. And it puts pressure on the remaining states. I think now that we're this many years into the Medicaid expansion and we have a very clear group of states that have expanded and a clear group of states that have not, it's very easy to compare the two and to compare the rates of insurance or being uninsured, how many people have medical debt, the actual health of the people in those states, and to see these very tangible benefits from expansion. And so, again, it just makes it that much harder for lawmakers in Washington to make another run at repeal.
Joe in Bowling Green, you're on the air with Politico healthcare reporter Alice Miranda Olstein. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hello. I happen to be working on my Obamacare application for next year right now, and the reason that I'm searching again on the marketplace is because I got a letter from my insurer saying that they're going to quadruple my premium next year. So I personally am not that happy with Obamacare. It was sold to us as a first step towards single-payer universal health care, and I'm just wondering, are you hearing anything, even a whisper from the new congresspeople coming in that somebody is going to try or advocate for single-payer universal health care? Because I believe that's what we need. I'm not at all satisfied with the ACA.
Alice Olstein?
Yes, great question. And there's definitely more than a whisper. There is now a whole Medicare for All caucus led by some House Democrats, and they definitely will be pushing for hearings on this right away. Because Democrats only have the House and not the Senate and the White House, I think you may see some movement towards this, but it'll be more about showing the American people this is what you could have if you elect Democrats to control the Senate and White House. So it's about sending a message ahead of 2020 because the ability to actually pass something into law is quite limited at this point. But it took years and years to pass the Affordable Care Act with many, many, many hearings. And so they want to at least get the ball rolling so that this is a possibility in the future.
Joe, thanks for that call. And Alice, are you hearing those kind of stories, quadrupling the premiums for Obamacare policies?
Yes. So some people are getting hit really hard and by those premium increases. The people who are getting hit the hardest are the people who make too much money to qualify for a subsidy in the Obamacare marketplace, but that doesn't mean they're rich by any stretch of the imagination. It just, you know, these middle-class consumers who don't qualify for these tax credits are getting slammed in a lot of places, and those are the people who have left the market the most and are now uninsured or maybe searching for these cheap, skimpy short-term plans or other options.
Alice, I guess I'm going to have to say goodbye to you now. I thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, anytime.
Alice Miranda Olstein is a Politico healthcare reporter. She's been covering the Affordable Care Act and what's happening in Congress or not, or what's happening in Washington. We're awaiting the ruling in a Texas courtroom right now. Federal judge in Texas, and whether or not that judge sides with Republican attorneys general and the Trump administration that want to see the Affordable Care Act abolished, a group of more than a dozen Democratic attorneys general who are opposing it. So we will continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment about the Affordable Care Act, about what's going on in Washington, we'll try to get to your answers and how much the midterms affected the dynamic and the discussion about health care for Americans. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Americans have until December 15 to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. The future of the law remains in play, but the prospects for Ohioans who need the coverage have brightened somewhat over the last year. Premiums have increased, but Anthem is joining the Ohio market, and the more the merrier when it comes to choice. Kathleen Geminer is a senior House Policy Associate at Voices for Ohio's Children, an advocacy organization focused on children. She is the former project director for the Universal Health Care Action Network. She joins us now. Welcome back.
Hi. Thank you, Ann.
You know, Ohio went red again, but there, you know, in other places like Wisconsin, the Democrats took over control. When you look at what happened in the midterms, can you give us kind of a broad brush from your point of view about what this means?
Well, first of all, I think that healthcare was a major issue for Ohio voters. I know there was a poll out right before the election that showed 77% said it was very important to them in their vote for governor. So I think we have to assume that the Ohio voters expect and counted on Governor-elect DeWine to stand in favor of health care. And he has said several times, you know, he is not going to oppose pre-existing condition protections and that he's going to preserve the Medicaid expansion. So those are things we kind of look forward to, that's going to be the case. And for families and children who Voices for Ohio's Children advocates for, that's really important.
But he could change his mind. I mean, nothing's set in stone. In fact, Republicans that control the Ohio General Assembly are very opposed to the Medicaid expansion.
They are. But do you know, Ann, 1/3 of the people on the Medicaid expansion are parents of young children. And we know from the research that kids are more likely to be covered and to be getting health care when their parents are covered. So I think it's I think now that he's actually governor and he looks at this and what it would mean for kids, we really think that he will protect the Medicaid expansion.
Let's talk about the fellow who called up earlier and said that his premiums had quadrupled, that he's working on re-upping right now and he's frustrated.
He's a good example of why it's so important for people to go on healthcare.gov and to take a look at the other plans. I don't know if this particular gentleman had a subsidy or not. Sometimes even people who have subsidies still see premium sticker shock because there are some new plans in Ohio that are being sold more cheaply. And that then becomes the benchmark plan to set the subsidy. So the people in the other plans suddenly see that their subsidies don't go as far as they used to. And so that's why it's so important to take a look at
but
the other
when
plans.
When you're looking at cheaper plans, are you still getting everything?
Well, people do want to look at that silver plan. I mean, that if you're getting a subsidy, definitely you want to be in the silver plan because that's where you can also get cost sharing help. And yes, you know, that's the difference between the Affordable Care Act plans and the other plans that your former guest was talking about, which were these short term plans that are starting to be marketed. They are not, they're skimpy and they're not covering all of the things that the Affordable Care Act provides for. But if you're in the marketplace and you're on healthcare.gov, you're going to get the plans that have all the protections in them.
And those skimpier plans, which were intended to be short-term plans, are you going to find those on the...
Nope. You will not. Not on healthcare.gov. And that's why it's important to shop there. And I'm even, you know, I'm on Medicare now and I'm getting robocalls advertising these short-term plans. So I can only imagine what other people are starting to hear.
People on Medicare that want supplemental insurance, can they go to the Affordable Care Act?
No. If you're on Medicare, the Affordable Care Act really, it does actually make some changes in Medicare that are good for people. Like it provided that people on Medicare can get a lot of screenings and preventive care with no cost.
It boosted the coverage
of
Medicare.
It did, but the plans themselves are not for people on Medicare. Medicare has it's a whole separate set of plans.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Kathleen Geminer. She's senior health Policy Associate at Voices for Ohio's Children, talking about, you know, what the kind of the nuts and bolts and the larger political outlook for the Affordable Care Act in Ohio and across the country. If you have a question or comment, we'll give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The Trump administration announced a $26 million cut to the Healthcare Navigator program. What is your sense about how that the cuts previously in the Trump administration to that program affected sign up last year? And what are you expecting it'll do this year?
Well, we did see a loss last year. It wasn't huge, but there was a modest downturn in enrollment. And I think that is largely a result of the much reduced money in the state of Ohio to pay for outreach services. We have only a few navigators with very small amounts of money in Ohio. We do have a lot of certified application counselors who are basically volunteers, if you will, or staff for organizations doing it voluntarily. The community health centers are CACs, and they're in, I think, something like 70 out of the 88 counties in the state. And for people that need help, going to those community health centers is definitely a good thing to do.
If they go to healthcare.gov, will they find who those navigators are? How
yes.
do you know? Okay.
They actually can go to healthcare.gov, and there will be something that says, a little box that says, do you need help? And then you put in your state, and it actually will give you all of these different resources. You put in a zip code, and yeah, you can get a lot of help that way.
What impact did the abolishment of the individual mandate have on this larger equation?
Yeah, well, you know, the mandate was not really abolished. It was the penalty.
Oh, that's right. Everyone has to sign up, but there's no penalty anymore.
Yeah.
I stand corrected.
So the penalty, that becomes effective for this tax year. And so we haven't seen it entirely, the impact of it. But I think what we're starting to find out is that people want coverage. They're beginning to understand, now that they've had coverage, what the value of that coverage is. And so I think in that sense, I'm not really expecting to see a strong fall off. And in fact, if we go back to what you were talking to your earlier guest about and the lawsuit that's pending right now, I think that it's becoming clear that this law does stand on its own, even when the penalty's not there. And so that it's going to be harder and harder, I think, for anybody to for even the court to overturn it, you know, in the face of strong public support for the law.
But it will be debated, no doubt. I mean, you mean in the final analysis?
Yes,
the U.S. Supreme Court.
I think that what we're going to see, it may go to the U.S. Supreme Court, but I think that if we look at precedent and we look at where public opinion is, I would find it hard to think that the Supreme Court would feel like it could overturn it on that ground. It's just a very flimsy legal ground.
You're listening again to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We were talking about the Medicaid expansion. What is your understanding about what the Ohio General Assembly could do to stop the expansion, regardless of what the governor wants?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they could try to do what they did the last time, which is they put in a provision that would freeze the Medicaid expansion as of a certain date. Mm-hmm. And we know that freezing the Medicaid expansion is tantamount to ending it over time. And that's because you have a lot of folks who toggle back and forth between an income that qualifies them for Medicaid, and then they get a raise or they have extra hours, mm-hmm. and then they go into the Affordable Care Act. And then they lose those hours, and they fall back into Medicaid eligibility. So if the freeze were to go into effect, they could no longer reapply. Exactly. And so over time, like probably in less than a year, we would lose most of those folks from the expansion. We hope And we have to take the governor at his word from his campaign promises, you know, that he would veto such a provision, because that would just it would end the Medicaid expansion. The other concern we have would be the work requirement. And that is something the governor has said he supports. But I think and I'm hoping he understands this better as he moves forward, that work requirements really result in a lot of red tape. It's not about working. It's about bureaucracy. People already are working. You know, over two-thirds of Ohio's Medicaid expansion recipients actually are working, or they're full-time caregivers. But what happens with the work requirements, and we're seeing this in Arkansas right now, 12,000 people in Arkansas have already lost their Medicaid. And Arkansas is not a big state.
Because of work requirements.
Because of the reporting requirements that are associated with the work requirements.
Okay.
So even PBS did a story the other night looking at a man in Arkansas who thought when he reported once on his work that that's what he had to do, didn't realize he had to report every month. He didn't know that he had lost his Medicaid until he went to pick up a very expensive prescription. Then he got sick and he couldn't work. And he lost his job, but then trying to go back, you know, find another job, he was too sick to work. So the idea that people should work in order to be healthy, yes, there is an association, but first you have to be healthy and then you can find work.
What about the prescription coverage that they're saying they could talk about? The Republicans and the Democrats could talk about a compromise on that. What are your expectations? And
you mean with respect to the cost to the taxpayers
and
all of that?
Yeah.
Well, I think that we've seen some debate just in the last week in Ohio's legislature around this. Right now, Ohio has adopted what they call a kind of a transparent system for still having managed care control take care of the cost of drugs within their package. And I think that's where Medicaid wants to lead things. I think they believe they can save enough money doing it that way. As far as whether or not we will see the cost of drugs go down for people who aren't on Medicaid in Ohio, I think certainly there will be some efforts, but I think largely we're going to see a lot of that left to at the federal with the Congress.
So what are you concerned about going forward? And I guess in the short term and the long term, but.
Yeah, what I'm concerned about right now is that we take advantage, that Ohio takes advantage of all the opportunities that are available to it. For example, we've heard recently from going and talking to people all over the state about the health of very young children, that there are some gaps in what Medicaid pays for. Kids that are in line to get speech therapy, that just shouldn't happen. Kids on Medicaid, they should be able to, we talk about getting kids ready for kindergarten. Well, if they're not getting the speech therapy, infant mental health is another area. Kids, there's a line. And we think there's a lot of things that the governor could put into his first budget. He could have an agenda. His kids' agenda could really include improving access of children to these various therapies that we're not seeing the plentiful availability of that we always thought we really had in Ohio. The other thing is we're seeing there's some other barriers like transportation. Medicaid pays for transportation, but do you know that mom can't take the sibling along if there's a doctor's appointment for the infant because the cab isn't going to have a car seat for that sibling or even a car seat for the infant? I mean, there's all sorts of transportation barriers that our state needs to take a look at to make sure that healthcare is really family friendly and that kids and moms and parents are getting the access that they need to have healthy, stable families. And of course, I think protecting the expansion is going to be just a really big thing. With a third of the people in the expansion being parents, being able to keep that coverage, those families between 90% of poverty, which is where the parents' coverage ends, and 138% of poverty, where expansion ends, that's a lot of people. And right now they're getting coverage and more kids are getting coverage. The other thing that I think is really important to look at is, and a lot of folks don't realize this, but we have lost a bit of ground in Ohio on enrollment of children in Medicaid. You know, we had really, we were one of the leaders in the country as far as getting our uninsured rate down. It was down to 3.8% for kids. We've crept up, according to census data, to 4.5%.
Which you think is a reflection of the fact that if the parents aren't covered,
If the parents aren't covered, the kids are less likely to be covered. That's part of the problem. We're not entirely sure of all the reasons for that fall off. And so that's something we would really want the DeWine administration to look at. You know, why is there some loss? Employer coverage is pretty flat. We'd like to think that, oh, it's because the parents got jobs and now they're on employer coverage. But employer coverage has been pretty flat. So we really would like this new administration to say, okay, why are we losing about 40,000 kids off of Medicaid? Let's see what we can do get them back. Yeah, and get them back on.
Ann in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Ann.
Hello.
Go ahead. Ann?
About Trump Care.
Trump Care. I haven't heard of Trump Care. Where are you hearing about this, Ann? Okay, we have a bad connection. We'll have to. But have you heard about Trump Care?
No. I think the people, I mean, Trump Care can be thought of in a couple of different ways. There may be people who actually think that the Trump administration is going to come up with a plan, but they haven't done that, and they've really done very little to improve health care for the average family.
Well, she said she's received emails about Trump Care. What cautions do you have for people who are probably getting, like you said, clobbered with all kinds of notifications?
Well, yeah, I think people, again, they just have to be really careful in looking at these health plans that are being advertised right now.
Don't be fooled. I mean, go to healthcare.gov.
And if it, yes, exactly. And, you know, always if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. If you're getting a quote for a really low price, you probably don't have coverage for pre-existing condition. You probably don't have maternity care. You probably don't have mental health and substance use disorder care. So these are all things that people need to be looking at in any plan that's advertised to them.
I'm being told that Trump Care is the nickname for the American Health Care Act. There is no such thing.
There was an American Health Care Act proposed.
But
and
it was
that's
never
what,
passed.
That's what Congress voted down.
Right.
A year ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't exist.
You're right.
Okay. It's not a thing, people. There is no such thing. Kathleen Geminer, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate
your
time.
You're welcome.
Kathleen Geminer is a senior health policy associate at Voices for Ohio's Children. She is a frequent guest on the show when we talk about the Affordable Care Act and always very helpful. Coming back, we're going to get a couple different points of view on what Congress should be working on, what's working at the federal level when it comes to the Affordable Care Act, and what might be coming down the pike. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Affordable Care Act is still the law of the land. There is no such thing as Trump Care. The law has been tweaked, however, the Affordable Care Act, by the Trump administration, and a lawsuit brought by 20 Republican attorneys general with the support of the Trump administration has challenged the constitutionality of the ACA. Still with us is senior health policy associate at Voices for Ohio's Children, Kathleen Geminer. Joining us now, executive vice president and chief operating officer of the Buckeye Institute, Rhea Hederman Jr. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
And by phone, director of healthcare at the Progressive Policy Institute, Ariel Kane. Welcome to the show, Ariel.
Thanks for having me.
So I thought I would start with both you and Rhea just asking about your short-term expectations for ACA. You know, what's happening now? How did the midterms affect things? Ariel?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few things that are definitely clear coming out of the midterms. First of all, repeal is currently off the table. With Democrats taking control of the House, the Republicans don't have a path forward. And so the question now becomes, will the Democrats and Republicans work together to improve the ACA, perhaps make plans in the individual market more affordable, particularly for those above 400% of the federal poverty level? But I think that the clear thing is that the ACA repeal is currently off the table.
Okay. Rhea?
Yeah, I think you're going to be looking exactly what Ariel talked about, is that we know that there are some people that are losers in the ACA. These are people that's incomes are too high, not getting the subsidies, young people.
But they don't make enough money to really afford it.
So they're going to be looking at alternatives. You know, can they look at increased subsidies? The administration, though, is taking their own actions, creating kind of some of these off-ramps through short-term plans, association health plans. So that's one path that could go forward, which you'll see more executive orders from the president. I think the other thing that you're definitely going to be looking at, which is a little bit outside the ACA, but there seems to be forming a bipartisan reform around pharmaceutical drugs. Mm-hmm. So you saw the president's secretary of health, Alex Azar, being very aggressive, and you saw a plan Bernie Sanders that still have some of the same components. So I'd imagine that you could see some bipartisan action on some attempts to lower drug prices.
But that would be for Medicaid, right?
It'd be
for everybody.
Yeah. So the administration was looking at drugs in Medicare, allowing importations, and reference pricings from foreign countries. Mm-hmm. And Democrats are saying, let's make it for everybody. But you are seeing kind of the same concepts that are now formulated in both Democrats and Republicans, and repeals off the table. They're going to be looking at trying to help, the losers.
As far as the repeal goes, they already tried it. They failed. I was kind of wondering, going forward, were they thinking if they kept the House, they would try it again?
Well, you saw you did see policy experts in Washington, and I was one of them, trying to figure out, what is another path forward. That I think, the idea of what the House bill had was a loser. And the idea was, could you use a regular order process, to get enough votes in the Senate? And of course, with the House now in Democratic control, that path forward's dead, but there still needs to be alternatives presented by Republicans and conservatives to what they think the future of healthcare looks like.
Yeah. Ariel Caine, do you think it can be a bipartisan issue at this point?
I think that is yet to be seen. So far, the only things that have been bipartisan in healthcare recently have been opioids. But we have seen, a lot of action around that and a lot of agreement on the need to address that. So if something can have a similar urgency in the larger healthcare market, I think we could see bipartisanship. But that's the question that I think is out there.
Rhea, you wrote in an opinion piece for The Hill that new guidelines from the Trump administration on the issue of state innovation waivers is good news. How so?
Sure. So, what innovation waivers are, there are a section in the Affordable Care Act that says if states can meet certain guidelines, such as, cover a roughly similar number of people, offer good health coverage, make it affordable, then states can come up with their own health care designs. And so we saw some innovation last year. A couple of Midwestern states were having an idea, say, what can we do to lower premiums? And we saw the Obama guidance basically was so high that really retarded states from coming up with big plans. States couldn't do it. And now what the Trump administration is saying is, look, if you have a better idea in your state to be able to offer this type of health coverage, let's go forward and look at it. Ohio's done that. You've seen a lot of states creating reinsurance programs that, using these innovation waivers, have lowered premiums anywhere from about 10 to 40% depending on which state.
But they also changed what you get.
So not in the reinsurance programs, but you have seen some of the plans saying, look, let's take a look and say what benefits make the most sense for our citizens. How can we make sure that the insurance is affordable so more people can be able to buy it? That's what a state like Iowa was looking at. And a state like Ohio was saying, can we look at changing some of the essential health benefits as well? Can we look at waiving the individual employer mandate? And I think what you're going to see is you're going to spur a lot more innovative thinking competition in the states.
Yeah, Kathleen?
Yeah, I just want to say that I think the possibility of using the 1332 waiver to get a reinsurance plan in Ohio is a place where there really is some bipartisan appeal. And that is a healthy way to reduce premiums. In fact, it's the way that the Affordable Care Act got started. We had reinsurance plans for the first several years, but it was time limited. The other ways of using 1332 waivers to actually start to peel back the essential benefits, that's something that we don't see as good for families and children. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we think we're concerned about the direction that the Trump administration is going on that aspect of the 1332 waiver.
And Ariel Kame, what do you think?
Yeah, I was just going to ask to jump in. So I think that reinsurance could also be something that we see bipartisan agreement on in Congress. That is one way where we could reduce premiums for those above 400% of the federal poverty level. But additionally, you know, there's a lot of latitude around the 1332 waivers, and we've seen some states experiment with work requirements, such as mm-hmm. Arkansas.
Right.
And Arkansas is actually kicked because of their work requirements and people not meeting, even if it's just reporting to the state that they are meeting those requirements. But you know, a lot of those people aren't reporting back to the state what they're doing. And so 12,000 people have been kicked off of the Medicaid program since they've launched it. So I think that, you know, there are a lot of good things. Reinsurance is a great example of states, you know, using these waivers to help make healthcare more affordable within their states. But also some states are doing things that are actually, you know, either limiting the benefits that are people getting or removing them altogether.
So, Ray Hederman, you're shaking your head when she's talking about the Arkansas example. Why?
Yeah, sure. The Arkansas is a Medicaid waiver. It's 1115. And so, you know, that affects the Medicaid program. And even under the Trump guidance of 1332, you can't count Medicaid savings. So I actually think the administration should go back to the original text and allow states to combine an 1115, which is a Medicaid waiver, which is like Arkansas, Ohio's work requirements, and a 1332. The 1332 waivers just apply to the health insurance coverage provisions
right.
in the Affordable Care Act. And so, you know, it's two different markets. And I think, you know, if you're looking at kind of where states were experimenting, the idea was, can you offer flat credits to help some of these people that weren't subsidized before, that have dropped out of coverage because it's no longer affordable, and be able to provide help so they could buy insurance markets? So you saw Iowa, you saw Oklahoma floating proposals like that to be able to provide assistance for them to purchase health insurance. And that's why I think there's a lot of flexibility. On the other side, you also saw states like Vermont, California, looking at implementing single-payer systems under the 1332 provisions. So 1332 gives states a lot of flexibility to how a state wants to look at their insurance markets.
Mm. Kathleen?
I'm suddenly aware of the fact that we've used the word reinsurance plan, and a lot of the listeners might not even know what that means. But basically, sometimes insurance companies are concerned about coming into a market because of that the population covered may be higher cost. And what the reinsurance waiver does, or the reinsurance plan, is offer some protection when there's some very high cost patients. So that's, you know, that's the plan that I think we are seeing some bipartisan agreement around. Ohio hasn't gone that direction yet, but it certainly could.
Mark in West Jefferson, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I was wanting to know if, now that the Democrats are in, are they going to try to unify the plan? From what I'm hearing, you say that you go to a different state, you get a different coverage from different state from state, make it more universal throughout the country, or are they just going to continue as they're going on? And could they also maybe include maybe like dental and vision?
Those are the $56,000 questions. That's not even included in my health insurance. But that's a good question. I mean, Ariel Kane, what is your sense about how far Democrats are going to push, given the fact that they only control one house and that the president's a conservative Republican?
Yeah, and I think you just hit the nail on the head. The reality is they only control one chamber, which can help them stop a lot of things from changing. But, you know, they're going to have to get some bipartisan support if they want to change and, you know, change anything. And I think that what the listeners suggested, great ideas, but probably not within the immediate future.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, I think one thing that's going to be interesting to see that what comes out of the Democratic House is, you know, Republicans for about 8 years campaigned on replacing the ACA, and they never really came out with a coherent plan to the last minute. And, you know, a lot of Democrats ran on a Medicare for all, you know, some type of
single-payer plan. There's certainly a strong contingent now.
But, you know, if you take a look at polling, you take a look at experts, you know, what that really means is still up in the air. So it'll be interesting to see how far they go putting pen to paper, coming up with their own plan, what they see as the next steps for the Affordable Care Act, either a replacement or an extension.
But, you know, Ray, do you think that this has sent a message to Republicans in Congress, though, that given the results of the midterm and that, you know, it wasn't economics, if it wasn't income or it wasn't, you know, the economy, it was the medical economy in the United States, stupid kind of a message.
Yeah, you know,
they have to change their approach to this.
Yeah, you know, Nancy Pelosi said the Democrats ran on three things: healthcare. Mm-hmm. And I think Republicans really struggle to have an answer to what their vision of the healthcare is. You know, how are they going to sit there and deal with pre-existing conditions? How are they going to deal with these types of subsidies and offering insurance payments? And I think that is going to be the big question for Republican policymakers drafting a plan that makes sense and then selling that vision to the American people, because, you know, with the unemployment rate down below 4%, that wasn't enough to really help them hold them a House majority.
Right. Yeah. Kathleen?
No, I think, you know, at this point, the thing that we're most concerned about is simply that however they decide to frame it, we know that with the protections that are now in as a result of having a Democratic Congress, we can expect to see Medicaid retain its robustness. It certainly passage of CHIP last year, extension for 10 years, was really important. And
that's for children.
That's for kids. And that's in place. And we know that the Medicaid program itself was really under threat during the entire process of looking at repeal and replace last year. And now we've got some protections there. And so I think the thing is, how can we go on and begin to close some of the gaps that exist, especially for those folks who are just above the level of getting subsidies.
Make too much money to get Medicaid, but don't make enough money to afford the ACA.
Yeah.
Last final thoughts, Ariel Kane, from where you sit. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've sort of touched on a lot of things. I think that there's likely to see bipartisanship around drug pricing. This is an issue that came up a lot and why healthcare was a top concern. People are concerned about drug prices. I think that we will see a debate emerge about what comes next for Democrats. And this will go into the 2020 election, sort of what the party coalesces around. I do think that they have benefited from the fact that Medicare for All is a very nebulous and ambiguous term, and people have used that to their advantage. I think ultimately people want assistance, but, you know, maybe not, don't want the whole system, you know, thrown out with the bathwater. So I think we'll see a robust debate and, you know, hopefully we'll see some bipartisanship around some short-term fixes.
Yeah. Ray, real quick.
Yeah, I think you're going to see states being the real laboratories and the excitement of where healthcare innovation is going to come from. I mean, you've seen Gavin Newsom, elected governor of California, talking about moving in single payer. Mm-hmm. You've seen administration with these waivers telling Republican governors, if you have a better approach, let's see it. Let's figure out a better way to deal with Medicaid. So there's going to be a lot of action in the state in the next 2 years and not much in Washington.
Ray Hederman, Jr., Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Buckeye Institute. Also by phone, Ariel Kane, Director of Healthcare at the Progressive Policy Institute. Thanks to you both, and Kathleen Geminer, Senior Health Policy Associate Voices for Ohio's Children. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.